these ideas are becoming more and more widespread, and I think they could lead to a sort of change of heart across the earth.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Amitav Ghosh, award-winning Indian novelist and writer. His new book is just out. It's called The Nutmeg's Curse, Parables for a Planet in Crisis. And that does it for our show. His previous book, The Great Derangement. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, we'll speak to climate scientist Kevin Anderson and the writer George Monbiot. Democracy Now! currently has job openings. Go to democracynow.org.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO, coming at you out of our southeast studios here hard on the banks of the Willamette River in Portland, Oregon. We're going to be talking about the banks of the Willamette River in terms of a really interesting project going on at Willamette Falls by the Grand Ronde Tribe, called the show Land Back at Willamette Falls, because the Grand Ronde are getting back some of their original homeland in that very, very historically important area. And to talk about this, I have two guests. I have my regular second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, who's a Dene and Dakota writer, editor of the anthology Edge of Morning, Native Voices Speak for the Bear's Ears, and the writer of the fairly recently published Standoff, Standing Rock, The Bundy Movement, and the American Story of Public Lands. And she is on the train coming back through the gorge where the reception is notoriously spotty. Are you with us, Jackie?
Yes, I am. I'm sitting here looking at the beautiful Columbia River, and I'm just gorgeous. So I won't lose connection.
Okay, we'll cross our fingers. And our other guest is David Lewis, who's a member of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, a descendant of the Takelma, Chinook, Molalla, and Santiam Kalapuya peoples of Western Oregon. He is engaged in research on the tribes of the Pacific Northwest while studying at the University of Oregon and working for the Grand Ronde Tribe. He also served as the director of the Southwest Oregon Research Project Collection at the UO Knight Library Special Collections. He has served the cultural programs of the Grand Ronde Tribe. And I go on. I link to this. It's if you click on his name on my program page at kbo.fm, you can find out that and more. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
So, with that, I will let Jacqueline Keeler kick off the show.
Yes. Good morning, everyone. So, I don't know if many people saw the news, but September 21st, the Oregonian reported that the Grand Ronde Tribe had they purchased the old Blue Heron paper mill in Oregon City, and a couple of years ago, and they've just begun demolishing it. It is a symbolic demolition, and this the paper mill is located along the Willamette Falls, which is it's the 17th widest in the world, and it's the largest waterfall in the Northwest by volume. And we will definitely our guest David will speak more to this, This was when the Love Falls was the home to a Chinook band, the Kowawa, and a villages there and fish, and still do. This is an extraordinary natural site located in Oregon City, and it's not accessible right now to the general public because of the old mills that are built along there. And so what the tribe is planning on doing is actually sort of making it accessible to the public, and also honoring their ancestors' ancient connection to the place, and restoring sort of the sacred site to it. And I would love to hear more from our guests about its history.
Go ahead, David. Yeah. I'm not sure. Her reception isn't so great. I'm not sure how much you heard of that. But go ahead. Talk about the history of the Willamette Falls.
Yeah, the Willamette Falls is the original homelands of the Clackamas and Kalaliwala tribes. And, they've lived there probably more than 10,000, more than 16,000 years, perhaps. Since time immemorial, as all tribes do. And they had, three villages at least around the falls, different chiefs there, different, villages at Clackamas. And all these people are interrelated, and they're all accessing the fishing resources and numerous runs that came down the Willamette River and of salmon that came over the falls of, they would fish for lamprey eel. They would, and then at certain times of the year, they may travel other places for other things too. But the falls has been our homelands of our people, the Clackamas and Kalaliwala, for a long, long time. And what Grand Ron is doing is just going back to its original territory and saying, this is our place, this is our falls. The tribes were removed to Grand Ronde. We have firm records that say this, and every scholar that I know working in this area confirms all this. It's been confirmed by scholarship for more than 150 years, and now our tribes, our tribes never actually left the falls. They were forced to leave. They were forced to remove their reservation. And they would return annually to fish the falls. And so we're just simply buying back the land that was taken from us through treaties and other sort of forced agreements more than 150 years ago.
Wow. Fantastic. And can you hear me okay right now, or am I very, very quiet?
It's okay now. It's like through a tunnel, so to speak. Yeah. But go ahead.
Let me switch off of mine.
Right. Can you hear me better now?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Can you hear better now?
Yes.
Sure. Great. So this is an amazing. So a lot of times, this is Native American Heritage Month, November, and a lot of people are talking about the issue of land back, the restoration of tribal territories, and this seems to be a really important story regarding this. And of course, the tribe purchased the land for a couple of million dollars, I believe.
Oh no, that's not good. So
lost her?
Yeah.
The tribe is actually. Can you talk a little about the process that went into that?
Yeah, I don't actually work for the tribe now. I used to some 8 years ago, but the tribe has been looking at this parcel of land, the Blue Heron site, for a number of years. I know that Oregon City, because I work with Oregon City quite a bit on various cultural projects. Oregon City has been looking for the tribe to be a partner at the site, and up to maybe a year ago when they bought the site, a little more than a year ago, they... they didn't have any sort of buy-in to all the culture, all the sort of tourism activities that were happening around Oregon City. And so now the tribe has, now with understanding that this is a now a kind of local fishing issue, that they want to maintain their rights to fish at the falls, that they're not getting rights from the places, they decide to buy into it, and are now working with numerous organizations around Oregon City to help with this sort of cultural tourism activities that are going around there by sort of redeveloping this Blue Heron site. I believe I've seen in the paper that they're actually going to clean up the falls as well. I mean, there's quite a bit of concrete and other debris in around the falls, because they actually changed part of the falls. They're going to try and clean as much as they can out of the river there to remake the original falls as good as possible, because it's actually pretty junky right now with lots of pilings and river debris, you know, the concrete debris. And so we're doing what we were supposed to be doing in terms of looking at the health and vitality of the river, the fish, people live around the river, and making sure that the river lives on into the future so people can access it in the future for fishing, for viewing, and for, you know, whatever activities they want to do.
Yeah. So this was the falls are just an extraordinary natural site. I think people in the Portland area are unaware of them because they're not really readily viewable because of all the mills built on all the construction around them. And I was reading some of your piece that you have on as a good Oregon historical site about the Willamette Falls. And I was just, could you talk a little bit about how your tribe was sort of, I mean, there was a steep reduction in population that occurred, and then forced removal to the reservation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just like all the other tribes in Western Oregon, the Clackamas peoples, the Kwalewale peoples, had diseases come along. You know, the malaria came along and destroyed them to the point where, you know, there was only 10 people out of every 100 people left alive. And those villages decreased, and that left openings for settlement of, you know, settlers in the area and other people who come into the area and start settling in the region. After settlement, the Oregon Trail started. You know, tens of thousands of people came every year into the area and began essentially replacing the tribal people and pushing them away from their original homelands. Oregon City was basically the epicenter of settlement. Everybody that came to Oregon went through Oregon City because that's where the land office is. That's where everybody had to get their land claim to go out to their lands and sort of take their free land from tribes. And so, the tribes had to deal with all that, and they still lived there. They still had longhouses there. Up into the 1850s, they had longhouses there. They were still fishing the falls. They kept on being pushed back further and further to the point where they had a village up on the higher escarpment above Oregon City, and that was like a small native community, and they were laboring for the various factories at the falls at that point. But most people were moved to Grand Ronde. They were moved away, and most people sort of fell out of the attention of local Americans in the area.
Yeah, there was the role of the falls was helping the United States to assert its sort of, I mean, that was where the first city was incorporated in this area. I think San Francisco, I heard, had to file its municipal incorporation papers at Oregon City, and it was really the falls that drove a lot of that, made it the center, and you know, the building of mills there to basically affirm the United States political ownership of the area. And I had read that the one of the last longhouses there had actually been burned down by settlers.
That's right,
And one of the last in there till pretty much the end, right? He didn't leave. Towards the end, there were just a couple dozen of tribal members left after the forced removals and and malaria.
That's right. There were just a few families. Yeah. Yep, that's right.
The malaria, I think I had read somewhere that they said the malaria was actually introduced purposely. Is that true?
You know, that is kind of an urban legend. I mean, clearly somebody brought it here. It wasn't from here originally. So it was brought by, it's assumed to be some fur trading vessel coming from the tropics up into Oregon, and then it turned out the Willamette Valley was a pretty good environment for it. But it wasn't, as far as we know, it wasn't intentionally introduced. We haven't found any kind of documentation that suggests he'll brought it here intentionally.
Okay, yeah, great.
Could I ask a question?
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of people know of the, you know, the existing larger reservations in the Northwest, among them the Yakima, the Warm Springs, and the Umatilla, all of which established by treaties actually of 1855. And there was actually a treaty of 1855 for the people that we're talking about, the Clackamas and the others. Could you talk about what happened to that treaty?
Yeah, so the Willamette Valley Treaty is the treaty that covers the whole of the Willamette Valley, including all the way up to the Columbia and the Falls. The people there in that treaty, the Clackamas, the Cascades, the Malala, all the Kalapuyan tribes, all signed on the treaty by January 22nd, 1855. They agreed to, at some point, move to the reservation at Grand Ronde. And they did. They eventually, by 1856, March 1856, most of those people were moved onto the Grand Ronde Reservation. And I've been documenting recently exactly when they moved, exactly where they went to, and I found invoices about paying for the removal. And so, so we know exactly when people were moved and what the agreements were, how they were treated, you know, who took part in that. I found, you know, people like Lot Whitcomb, who founded, you know, Milwaukee, had played a pivotal role in moving the people off the Columbia and down to Grand Ronde. And so, so that was absolutely the case. It's a different treaty. I think some of the questions are the treaties the same, the treaties for Middle Oregon the same as the treaties for the Willamette Valley? And no, it's not at all the case. The treaties for Middle Oregon, for whatever reason, have better rights in them, for, you know, securing fishing and hunting rights, whereas the Willamette Valley Treaty has no mention of those rights. And that's has been a problem for Grand Ronde for a long time. But in terms of Indian law, the lack of mention of rights to fish do not exactly take away those rights to fish either. There's nothing that takes away our rights to fish. And so we technically have the right to fish because nothing was ever taken away from our people originally who had original sovereignty on the land.
But that the Willamette Valley Treaty wasn't actually formally ratified, was it?
Oh, absolutely was, yeah.
It was.
With treaties, anything that hasn't been explicitly given away, those are reserved rights. So
right.
So those things are implied to have been retained if they haven't been explicitly given up. So I think.
Yeah. The treaty is absolutely ratified. It was ratified within 3 months, on March 3rd, 1855.
My mistake. Go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, I feel like the story about the falls, the Willamette Falls being restored, and by the tribe, by, you know, its most ancient inhabitants, has not been covered very well in the press. How do you feel that way, or do you think it's because it's such a sort of a preliminary stage?
Yeah, I think that is the case. You know, I think part of the problem is most people that are in the press don't know anything about tribes. They're learning, like, on the spot about tribes. Many reporters are new to the beat and stuff, and they don't really understand much about tribal history. And that's really the case across the Northwest. And so, you know, we're a lot of times having to correct them. And so what we've seen instead is a bunch of editorials from other tribes about Grand Ronde's actions at the falls. And I've seen really kind of explosive editorials coming from tribes like the Umatilla, suggesting that we're expanding our area into the area of Willamette Falls, which is not at all the case. That's a ludicrous argument, because our people originally came from the falls. So how do you suggest that we expand into the falls back to our original territory? That doesn't make any sense at all. I've seen lots of arguments suggesting that we're trying to keep away, that Grand Ronde is trying to keep away people from the falls, and I have not seen anything in what the Grand Ronde have done that have suggested that nobody else can come to the falls. It's absolutely, I mean, I can't speak for the people at Grand Ronde, the government of Grand Ronde right now, but I know those people, and I know that they are aware that other people would come to the falls and trade there and have some, familial fishing rights there and would fish there. And I think they'd like to honor that. I think what's happening right now is we're having to be very, very diligent on saying this is our place. We are allowed to build, a fishing scaffold here. We're allowed to land here because we've been in this place for a very long time. And they're having to basically be very protective of our area, work with the state of Oregon to protect that area, because other tribes are saying that we have no rights there at all, and that's not at all the case.
And so talk more about this. These might be a little sort of complicated intertribal sort of discussions and controversy that maybe people are not very familiar with. Obviously, you're talking about it being a historically major fishing site. Not comparable to Celilo, which Jackie just passed on the train, which was just the preeminent site in the Pacific Northwest, and which was flooded. And there's very, very few sites that, because native people traditionally fished a lot of the time at these falls, where the fish kind of slowed down before jumping up over the fall and continuing their migration path. So it's a very optimal place, an optimal place to build platforms. You're just talking about the platforms. And so both the salmon, steelhead, lampreys. And so anyway, maybe talk a little bit about this. What's behind some of this? Just to explore a little bit before we get more into that project, at the ex blue heron site, there's obviously there's competition for resources, because there's fewer and fewer resources, and there's not as many opportunities for native people and other people.
Yeah, it appears to be exactly what's happening. What you're suggesting is, with other falls being destroyed or somewhat destroyed by the reclamation damming projects of the 1950s and earlier and later, that we're seeing less and less fish on the river, and the fish runs are dying. Numerous fish have died off. And the tribes are continuing to try to sort of practice their culture. And what's happening is, because the tribes in Windle, Oregon have these express fishing rights in their treaty, they say they get to fish at usual and custom places. Some of their tribes that came to places like Warm Springs were like the Hood River Wasco people, which we used to be called the Hood River Cascades people, and they were absolutely related to the Wascos upriver that were using Celilo. They're also related to the other Cascades people at Cascade Locks, and those people were all related to the Clackamas people that were at the falls. There was lots of interrelationships up and down the river, like familial interrelationships. And so it is the case that numerous of these people upriver had rights through family connections to come to the falls and fish. And I don't think anybody in Grand Ronde is suggesting that's not the case. It's we're just trying to protect our rights to fish at our falls.
So I took some sorry, that's the train's making a sound. But I looked at the Facebook pages for Oregon City, and And there seems to be a lot of support, actually, for the tribe's role in restoring the falls. And the paper mill has been abandoned for some time. I think it shut down in 2013 before the tribe purchased it in 2019. And the local Chamber of Commerce and other groups were unsuccessful in trying to redevelop it themselves. So I think from the white population, I should say, they seem very excited about the tribe's role. And there were some questions about whether this could lead to a casino. I think most of the people there felt that was okay because they need development. But there is, that land was not taken into trust, was it, formally, in the way that you would to be able to build a casino on it.
Yeah, I think the tribe has, I don't know what the tribe's thinking about, take the land in trust or not. They may decide to do that in the future. I don't know. I think they may keep it out of trust so they can do more with it. You know, the tribe does own quite a bit of land. Not all of it goes into trust. We do have a lot of trust land, and the tribe is really proficient at putting land into trust. They have a really good land office. So that shouldn't be too much of a problem, but they do want to be a good partner to the various organizations around Oregon City. They're looking at some sort of cultural tourism activities, and they want to make sure that they don't put any barriers in the way of that happening. So I'm not sure where they're going with the trust argument or not. I haven't heard anything about them developing a casino there. So I doubt they're looking at that. They have other property in Portland, like the former Greyhound track, that they may be developing instead.
Let me just...
Go ahead. I was just going to say that the tribe's main focus seems to be in restoration of this sacred space, from my reading and quotes that I've seen from different tribal leaders.
That's right. I think that they are looking to restore... I think, number one, they're really looking to restore our cultural activities there, because our people have not been sort of freely been able to fish there for a very long time. And they're, for whatever reason, the PG&E plant that crossed the river decided to not allow us to have access to the river from their side. I believe there was blame of, you know, pressure from other tribes and not make that not happen. But tribes, we want to have access there. The only way we could assure access is if we own a piece of property right on the falls. And that was an expensive venture. I think it cost somewhere in the range of $14 million. But the tribe decided it was worthwhile because, you know, there's really no monetary value on replacing your culture, returning your these major cultural locations on your landscape. I mean, it's invaluable. It's you really have to do something like that. You know, the tribe has been in the process of restoring itself since it was terminated in the 1950s and restored in 1983. And so part of that restoration is actually reestablishing connections to parcels of land that are integral to the tribe, including Willamette Falls and other places around Western Oregon.
I just want to reintroduce the show. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. I'm the regular weekly host, Paul Roland. I have my second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, a Dene and Dakota writer living here in the Portland area. And I've been doing this, we've been doing this together for a number of years. And also on the telephone is David Gene Lewis, who himself is a tribal member of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, though not previously in the past had worked formally for the tribe, and he makes clear that he does not formally represent the tribe in this conversation, but he does know a lot about what he's talking about. I just want to just say that we actually met first many, many, many years ago, where you were doing a public presentation at the Historical Society there in Oregon City, and I actually taped that, and I meant to look that up and see if I can get that archived tape and link to it, because it was a really wonderful talk. And it should be there. And then, so I've had you on a couple times. We actually talked last a number of months ago about the incident at the Oregon Historical Society, where some windows were smashed and then and some monuments were taken down elsewhere. Anyway, so that's reintroducing who you're hearing here on the program. I just wanted to, before I want to ask one question, but before I do, maybe explain a little bit more about that, you know, as short as you can, because I know it's a really long subject and a complicated one, but the termination and the restoration, what does that mean?
Yeah, the federal government decided in the 1940s to terminate essentially all tribes in the United States, and it went after tribes that looked like they were assimilated first. And Grand Ron and Siletz and all the Western Oregon tribes were terminated in that first round. Our termination bill was signed in 1954, and we finally terminated in 1956. What that meant is basically they terminated our agreements, the treaties of agreement that had been ratified previously. And then after they terminated, then they liquidated the tribe itself. So that means they sold off all the assets. And we were terminated for some 29 years. And then in the 1970s, we became active in trying to restore ourselves, like a lot of other tribes across the United States that had been terminated. And in 1983, we were successful with the support of most tribes in the area that were already established that had never been terminated before, like Warm Springs. And so we have been restored as a government since 1983, and we've had land since 1988, and we've been restoring the tribe, bringing back functions that manage our people and our culture and our sovereignty since that time, so for more than 37 years. So.
And so the it explains a lot about a lot of these sort of complicated, also these complicated intertribal discussions. We can't get too much deeper into, but you know, the fact that you say you did, that's very interesting that you said that you didn't actually, according to the interpretation of the law you're referring to, that you didn't actually lose your treaty rights, because I always thought that was a big, huge issue in the restoration process, that you couldn't actually assert, that the Grand Ronde and the Siletz couldn't actually assert their treaty rights because there would be so much backlash from the people on those rivers there, the Western Oregon rivers. But anyway, you can respond or not to that if you wish.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it is very complicated. I think that's why there's people like me to explain all this.
Yeah.
So it's very, very complicated. So yes, we did not lose our fishing rights during treaty times. We sort of maintained them up into the time the treaties were terminated in the 1950s. And then as a process of, you know, in the process of restoration, there's a lot of discussion, and, you know, first with the Siletz tribe, because they were a little bit ahead of us by a few years, and there were lots of activation by, you know, sporting groups like the fishermen's and hunting groups that suggested that if we were going to be restored, you know, like Siletz be restored, they would destroy fishing rights in the Northwest, or fishing for anybody in the Northwest. And so that was in the midst of what we call the fishing wars, this whole time period where, you know, the states were suggesting that with that tribes have been terminated, didn't possess any rights at all to fish, and we were sort of challenging that, and the tribes won those court battles. But but in order to get restored, we had to agree to get rid of our fishing rights and hunting rights, or not have those rights in our restoration. And so we did agree to that, just to be restored. It doesn't mean we don't want to keep to have rights to fish, and we're not, instead of working through the federal government now, which is how we restored, we're instead working through the states, as you know, being a good partner, being a good environmentalist, you know, protecting our lands. You know, the tribe is working on its own fishing resources and hunting resources on its own land, at some 10,000 acres for nearly 40 years now, and we've shown to be a good partner to the state. And so we've maintained good relationships with the state, and now we've been working through the state to regain some hunting and fishing through what we call ceremonial rights, which doesn't sort of open the door to everybody to come fish and hunt. It just allows us to take some fish in some animals for ceremonial rites or ceremonial events. And so so we don't actually have sort of federal rights to fish in terms of that direction, besides what Jackie mentioned as the reserve rights. We do have these sort of rights under state laws that we can fish under certain conditions.
I just want to let people know that this is a call-in show. 503-231-8187 is the number to call in and join this conversation. Fascinating conversation. 503-231-8187. If you're still with us, I assume you are, Jackie. I want to go ahead and.
I understand also during the termination process that many tribes were taxed by the state, back taxed to when the state was founded. Did that happen to the Grand Ronde tribes?
Would you say packed by the state or passed?
Taxed.
I don't. The state had really nothing to do with the tribes when the tribe was founded. They tribal lands is outside of the state jurisdiction. So
termination. I know that some tribes were back taxed by the state, like the Menominee in Wisconsin. They were forced to pay taxes on their land.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Back to the founding of the state. Yeah.
The tribes. You know, that didn't happen for Grand Ronde and Siletz. The Menominee did become a county, became Menominee County, and so they had state representatives, you know, in that area. We didn't have that. We just lost our land, and people became citizens of the state. And so there was a lot of discussion about what would happen at that time period by the state, because they realized they're going to all of a sudden have thousands of people come into state citizenship. They'd have to sort of manage all these people. Almost, they thought of it, they would be all welfare recipients, and I think by and large that was the case. The state did do what they can to stop it, but you know, I mean, there are individuals in the state that tried to sort of help, but people like the governor of the state at the time, Douglas McKay, was totally for termination, wanted to get all of the resources of the tribes that we had left, and he took the job as Secretary of the Interior in I think it was 1952, just so that purpose. He actually pushed termination at the federal level and was able to terminate some 109 tribes nationally.
I think that's a story that most Oregonians don't know that well. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, it's just so important, you know, if people look going forward, you know, this is going to be a really, really interesting and I presume, you know, beautiful in a lot of ways project, you know, just gaining access to be able to see the falls from up close and, you know, the restoration work that you're talking about is really, really encouraging. But as this goes forward, it's just really important to know this, the backstory, why it just is just a natural thing, why it's just makes sense for the Grand Ronde to, you know, to reassert their presence, reestablish their presence there. And, you can go off on that, David. I just want to go back to what Jackie was saying just about the difficulty of access. Just for anybody's, it looks like we have one caller. We'll go to you in just a second. But, you know, I know there's one pull out on 99 where you can get some view of the falls, and I actually found out that there's a turnoff, a viewpoint off of I-5 coming north, way up high, where you can actually, if you walk down, there's the trees kind of obscure a lot of the view. You can kind of get a view from up there, but it's not easy, and so it'll be, you know, people who fish close to the falls get a magnificent view if you go on a boat right up there. I did that one time, and it's just astounding. It's just a magnificent, it's just hard to believe it's there sometimes if you haven't gotten a chance to really look at it. So that, I don't know, just talk about maybe your own enthusiasms, knowing the history of the fall for what this project, you know, represents to both the Grand Ronde, to you, the Grand Ronde, and to, you know, people in general of the area.
Yeah, it's pretty astounding place. I mean, I visited numerous times, and you know, toured the Blue Heron plant down on the island, you know, stopped at all the viewpoints, taking pictures. I mean, it's a pretty amazing place. And it changes, too. It's not the same every time. If you come in the wintertime, after it's been raining, there's a lot more water than later in the summertime. And it's really dramatic when you see, like, trees coming down and lodge in the falls. And you can even sometimes, during the fish runs, you can watch the fish jump over the falls. So it's a really astounding place. I mean, I think all the view sheds were created at a time when there was tons of buildings around the falls. So nobody really thought that there would ever be a, you know, a more upfront view shed of the falls, because it all been really pretty well developed for more than 150 years there. I mean, what's interesting is, you know, the falls is really a significant place just in the history of the United States, too. You know, it was the first place that electricity was generated and transferred by power lines to Portland, to a city somewhere far away.
First long-distance electric transmission in the world.
That's right. It's a really significant place because it's a constant generator of energy, and people use that for more than 150 years here in Oregon to run all kinds of plants, to run all kinds of mills and things. And so, you know, it is a significant place, and I think we could do a lot more to attract people there, to have people come see it, to understand the history there, understand our history as tribal people there. I think there's a lot that can be done.
Well, we do have our first caller. John is on the line. We have only one line open, so you'll have to wait till John gets off to call 503-231-8187. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you, Dave, for your work in educating the people of Oregon about the Native people and the Native culture of the Willamette Valley. I have a question concerning the people of the Tualatin Valley. Yesterday I heard a little KBOO promo about the native people of the land, the Multnomahs and others, and they talked about the Tualatins. My understanding is that that's not the name of the people of the valley, the Tualatin Valley. They were actually the Atfalati or Atfalati, and that they were the original people of this area, of the Tualatin Valley. There's also a school in North Plains that's being built now called, I believe, Atfalati Ridge. I don't know where the ridge came from, but the Atfalati people, I guess, came from here. Anyway, if you could comment on that, on the nomenclature, as it were, because I know this was the territory, I believe, of the Atfalati that became the territory of Tualatin. Dave, if you have some comments on
that. Yeah, the Tualatin word is actually an Americanization of Atfalati. It became, at some point in the 1850s, Tualatin, going from Atfalati to Tualatin, and it's become Tualatin. And so that's kind of an Americanization of a native word, which is pretty common in the area.
Is the Atfalati, is it really proper to refer to the people of the area as the Tualatins when they never used that name themselves? And also, it seems to me that if KBOO is going to talk about native people of the land, they should use the proper nomenclature.
Well, the Grand Ronde tribe says Tualatin, so I don't know. You know, I mean, I guess every tribe has various versions of their name. I think I've seen 20 or more various versions of how you spell Kalapuya itself.
It's a long way from Atfalati to Tualatin.
Yeah, I understand that, and I think the tribe understands that. I think that the problem is that much of this Americanized words are written into treaties. You know, and so we kind of have to use that word in the treaties. If we say Atfalati in a political context, in a legal context, nobody knows what we mean.
Was Tualatin used in the treaty?
Yeah.
That was the term rather than the Atfalati.
That's right.
Okay, well, thanks for calling, John. That's an interesting point.
Oh, maybe KBOO should use the proper term.
Okay.
I don't know.
Well, we'll talk about that. Thank you, John. And 503-231-8187 is the number to call in. We have only about 15 minutes left. We're talking about, speaking of nomenclature, was there a term for the falls in the local people's language?
Yeah, I think they call it Tum Tum, Willamette Tum Tum, or Highest Tum Tum. It means like large falls, high falls. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's turn it back to our my co-host Jacqueline Keeler. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah, I that was an interesting question. yeah, I think and you know, citizen of the Navajo Nation, you know, we call ourselves the Ney, the Ness, and but you know, I think it's as David mentioned, you know, some I know that with covering Standing Rock, you know, we had to refer to the Great Sioux Nation when we're referring to the Fort Laramie Treaties, because that's what they were actually, the U.S. Senate ratified them under. And so, yeah, although we exist as independent, or, you know, not independent, we're one Dakota Lakota, my father's Dakota, Dakota Lakota people, we are all part of the Great Sioux Nation under this legal term. So there's a lot of ways in which that works. And but I would love to hear the original names of these places. I think you, the pronunciation for the falls is Tumwada, is that right?
Tumwada is another one, yeah. So there's various versions of Tum Tum, Tumwada, Willamette Tum Tum, Highest Tum Tum. Yeah, there's various words, yeah.
And then the river is Willamette, which is actually where Willamette comes from, right? The name.
Yeah, Willamette was a village on the river across from Clackamas. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I would love to hear from folks. You know, more. I think what I've seen is that there is a lot of excitement about what's going on in Oregon City, and I'd love to hear from people from Oregon City what they feel about it, and then people who have visited the falls, the Willamette Falls, to see what they felt. I thought that I really loved both your description of it, David, and also Paul's description. It makes me want to go out there in a boat myself right away and go see it, and it's quite extraordinary. I think it's yeah, I mean. And then what you mentioned about the fact that it was the first long-distance transmission of electricity in the world occurred from electricity generated from the falls and yep. transmitted to Portland is absolutely fascinating. I think we don't, and I think what the tribe is doing, what the Grand Ronde tribe is doing with redeveloping, yeah, they're redeveloping is somehow like not, feels like not the right word. They're reasserting our relationship to this natural wonder. In a way that is more appreciative, more respectful to it. Would you say that's right?
I think that's exactly right. I think that we've talked for years, because initially when I was in the tourism discussions at Oregon City and talking with all the city leaders and stuff, they were just talking about like heritage tourism or cultural tourism activities. And then we began saying, wait a minute, you know, we really are stewards of this land. We really care about, you know, the land itself. So we need to have an environmental piece in here too. We need to have some attempt to clean up these falls. They're really junky and dirty right now, and so we need to clean up all the stuff that's happened to them over the last 150 years. All that concrete, all those pilings that we've taken out of the river. We need to reestablish that natural wonder that we all know is there.
Well, we do have. Speaking of. Looking for people to talk about their experiences. I'm not sure if Edie has her own experience of the fall, but she does have something she wants to say on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. Could you please make some specific action plan requests of the listeners? For example, mm-hmm. listeners do A and or B and or C.
Well, David, do you want to encourage people who are listening to this program to do something? I don't know if there's anything to do about this particular project. It's going forward.
Well, I think there's quite a bit of still lack of understanding about all these issues. I mean, I suggest people actually continue to read as much as you can about the tribal histories, because I think that, you know, what this is all teaching us is that people don't know anything about tribes. You know, there's lots of folks today that still think that tribes that are pretty far away are the original tribes of Portland, and that's not at all the case if you look at the actual history. And so I think it would help out all of us out immensely if everybody just continue to do your homework, continue listening to things, continue to reading things, and to begin to understand more in depth the history of this place. And then when these discussions come up, we can have a high-level discussion about all these things And I think that that would help us all out a lot.
Because there's so much misinformation out there. Can you have Paul put on the website or mention on the air some really good sources to get up to speed, particularly for folks who are not in-depth readers with a lot of background?
Well, let me, I'll turn that over to Dave in just a second, but I'll give a plug for his work. One of his many, there's, if you actually Google, you know, Willamette Valley Tribes or, you know, Clackamas or various things, a lot of times you'll be referred to the work of David Lewis. He's very present on the internet. Anyway, I want to put a plug for the Oregon Encyclopedia, which is a project of the Oregon Historical Society, tying together our previous program with you about OHS. And so if you go to the you know, the program page, kbo.fm, and click on, you know, his name, David Lewis, is highlighted in green, you'll go to this entry for him in particular. But I neglected to put the entry for Willamette Falls, which he also did. I will correct that after the program. And there's many other, maybe talk a little bit about that, because that really is a place where you can get really quick and concise information on that Oregon Encyclopedia. Maybe talk a little bit about that project.
Absolutely. The Oregon Encyclopedia has been around for 13, 14 years now. And I was brought on about that time, even before I worked at for Grand Ron, and I've been working on their writing. I've written more than 30, I think, articles now for the encyclopedia. But yeah, I mean, I think there's quite a bit of information on there about tribal histories and stuff that I've been trying to add to. And since that time, I've also taken on my own project, my Indian History Research Project, which I now call the Cortex Journal, which has more than 470 now articles on tribes in Western Oregon, and I've been trying to sort of ferret out all these histories. But and I have some stuff. Well, I have a lot on there on the Clackamas, on the people, the Cascades, and those peoples that are around the Portland area. If you look it up, there's various indices to sort of find stuff. And then there's also a pretty good book out there called Chinookan Peoples of the Lower Columbia by Robert Boyd, and as the lead editor, and that has a lot of really detailed information about Willamette Falls and the people in that area. So,
what's your personal project called again?
The Cortex Journal.
And how do you spell that?
Like Quart, UX.
Okay. Thank you for that, and thank you, Edie, for your good questions. And unless Edie has something else to say, I know we only have about 6 or 7 minutes left. Maybe we'll let Edie go and invite one more caller at 503-231-8187, and once again invite my co-host Jacqueline Keeler back.
Yeah, I really want to check out all those entries at the Oregon Encyclopedia. His article on Willamette Falls is really quite comprehensive, and I really do suggest folks read it. And I'm very interested in reading the Cortex Journal as well. And what was the name of the book again that you just mentioned that really goes into a lot of detail about the falls?
Yeah, Chinookan Peoples of the Lower Columbia.
Can you say that again?
Chinookan Peoples of the Lower Columbia.
Okay, great. Thank you. We'll put all that on the. Paul will put those on the links on the website for this episode. And I think that was a great question about, you know, what are some concise sources, and certainly this does reveal, I mean, what we don't know. I mean, even as a Native person myself, not being from a people who are not Native to this area, you know, learning about the falls I was just amazed. You know, I don't think that we talk about it enough, and a lot of it is because it's been so used for such industrial purposes. It has not been available for, you know, I guess to appreciate it at a more deep level, I think. I should say that I am also working on a story about this from Oregon Business Magazine, so there will be some local coverage. There has been good coverage about the development. I understand that the project did get some federal grant money as well recently, and so I think it's and I'm excited to see what the cleanup looks like, and the lead that the tribe is taking in this.
Let's go to, we have one more caller. Let's go to that call. Oh, I just heard the train horn. That was great. Going through the gorge. That's Jackie Keeler. Anyway, so let's go to our last caller. Go ahead, you, Mahesh. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah, I just dropped in on the last part of this show, so I'm not sure if this is entirely what you're talking about, but names and couple different local history names that I wanted to get out there. First is the name of the ship by the Tillamook Cheese Factory on the coast is called the Morning Star, and that was named after a Native American woman who was from Tillamook. And there's a very sad story behind that, and they're using it as kind of a tourist attraction and all, but. Anyways, Star of Morning was a young woman from Nestucca, where I grew up, actually, near Cloverdale and Pacific City. And there was basically, when they built that ship in the 1800s, the shipbuilder was really crazy and was in love with her and had her her husband, you know, not quite a husband, but lover, killed by the Yamhill Militia. I'm not sure if you know, but the Yamhill, what's now Yamhill, was the Yamhill Army District, and they had sent all the people down there from Portland that, you know, couldn't, all the violent, the drunks and stuff, and they're very abusive to the Native Americans. But anyhow, the story behind Star of Morning is a very sad story, and so, you know, every time I go to the cheese factory and I see that ship, you know, I just think people should know the real story about Star of Morning.
Okay.
And they also got the name wrong. They put the name backwards on the ship.
Well, we're almost out of time, and it is very interesting. It is a little further afield from what we're actually talking about, Lamb Falls. But name any place in Oregon, there's going to be a story about the, you know, the original place names,
yeah,
and reclaiming the place
name. Since you're out of time, one last point. The person who did very much harm as well, his name was Thurston. Thurston, there's a lot of names after him in Washington and maybe even in Oregon. Anyways, he was a very bad person. His name was Thurston.
Okay, well, we're gonna have to let that go, because we need to give a little time for David to, I don't know, the classic call for final thoughts. But, you know, going forward, I mean, is there some sort of timeline? When can we sort of, do you think we can see some of the first work being done on this? And I don't know.
Well, I think they've already started work. There's already demolition happening there. Grand Ronde has its own construction company, so they can do their own demo projects. And I think that we're going to start to see, I think they did access some federal funds to help with the river cleanup and maybe some construction. And they're going to be doing that over and over again. They're going to be going after sort of federal money to help sort of restore those falls. And really, they should be. I mean, the federal, it's actually, we start looking at the whole site, it's a huge federal, you know, cleanup site. It should be a Superfund site where they actually bring in, you know, federal money to help clean that place, because it's been destroyed by industry for more than 150 years. So we need to do a lot of work there and bring back the vitality and the beauty of those falls.
Jackie, last question.
Yeah, I totally. There's the train again. I totally agree with that. There is a federal responsibility there, and because of the as you mentioned, you know, it is a Superfund site. And also, I think the Army Corps of Engineers is actually has control of the locks that were once operational there but are not anymore. But so yeah, I definitely agree with that. And thank you so much, David. And I'm going to really read all your articles, and I really appreciate your work as a historian.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, and I will thank both of you, Jacqueline Keeler and David Lewis, my guests today, and go to our website, kboo.fm, and look up Land Back at Willamette Falls is the name of the program today. With that, I thank all of you for listening and the people called in, and sorry for the people who wanted to call in and didn't get to. This is Paul Rowland for Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
So take heart and take care.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Did you miss the Afro-Caribbean and Reggae Marathon? No worries. You can go to kboo.fm/ACR to listen to the archived show. You can also snag a limited edition KBOO Afro-Caribbean and Reggae hoodie